5 past 10, have you downloaded yet?
The app.
Did it say intuitive? App? Actually, I don't know that I can actually have it playing while I've got my kilometre marker telling me how far I've run, but I could try it.
You can do it.
Otherwise, I have to run with the radio on one ear and...
No, if you're just tuning in, Caroline Salisbury, local dietitian, who we call the Fit Dietitian, is with us, so hence her kind of comment about running.
Sorry.
It's hard to get her in the studio anymore. She just kind of lapses, pops in, sits in a chair for a little while before she jogs off again.
Finally.
She's taken the whole to its hysterical extension, really.
Yes.
But other than the newspaper editors, I did love that Clark and Dawes.
Yes.
The physical loveliness.
That is.
Be still my beating heart. Yes. Don't you love John Clark?
I do love them.
That kind of writing. 6 past 10 now. Caroline, 1300 681 666. We love your calls in this spot. And the text number is 0467 922 666. You can tweet. Put at 666 Canberra in your tweets. Talking about taste and why taste matters.
Well, yeah. Last fortnight we talked to the scientists from CSIRO about the cyber nose and really trying to engineer the complexity of the human sense of smell and perhaps taste into something they could use commercially. But this is a wonderful book called Taste Matters by John Prescott. And John can give us his title in a moment because it's quite interesting. But I was talking in the coffee shop this morning, we had this little survey, as you do, of what foods do people really like and what do they not like and what is it about they don't like? And I said, I don't really like marmalade. And someone said, I don't like the way that dried fruit tastes in cake. So there are some background flavours that a lot of us just can't really come to love.
And then we can't understand everyone else's dislikes. You go, what, really?
Yeah, it's interesting how, and I guess John can tell us how much of that is genetic, how much is learnt, how much is cultural. Do all cultures have similar sorts of ranges of flavours in foods, but just with different background flavours?
John Prescott, welcome.
Good morning.
Great to have you on the show.
My pleasure.
So, John, tell us your title. What are your principal areas of work?
Well, the title of the book is Taste Matters, Why We Like the Foods We Do. And
but your title, you're a centre.
Oh, sorry, my title.
Yes.
Well, I suppose I started off life as a psychologist, studying sensory psychology, and moved into the study of smell and taste, and developed an interest in how food preferences develop. So, and I've been working in initially in CSIRO, and then in a variety of universities since then, studying these topics.
So was that initially from a commercial point of view in terms of developing, the flavours that manufacturers can then use in processed foods or?
Not directly. I think CSIRO, of course, has a mandate to try and help industry, but my interest was always in the basic processes of human behaviour and human perception that are behind our appreciations of smells and tastes. Now, of course, that's is directly relevant to the industry. A lot of basic research does eventually get translated into things which can be of use to the industry.
Mm. And John, this topic has hit me at a good time because I've recently just come back from holidays and I'm staying at a hotel in Malaysia where they have that buffet breakfast, and it was mainly a Chinese clientele. And it was so interesting. They were putting out food for Westerners, Chinese, for Japanese, for Malaysians. And the different food choices at breakfast, they were extraordinary and fascinating.
Yes, I thought for a moment you were going to mention the fact that there was durian on the breakfast buffet.
I made friends with the chef, and he kept coming out and pointing me to a cake which was using durian. Durian were in season when we were there.
Oh, that's what's great luck, isn't it?
This is the smelling fruit.
Because, John, a lot of what we actually appreciate about food when we first come to think about consuming it is actually the smell.
Well, absolutely. That's the one of the first signals as to what the food is. So if you come into a kitchen or anywhere the food is made or prepared, and the thing that hits you first is the aroma, and that actually is very important in helping you identify what's there and whether you're likely to like it or not. And if you do like it, if it's familiar, it'll often get the gastric juices flowing, and it actually will be a great stimulus for you to want to eat. So the smell is extremely important. And, of course, the smell is an important part of what we call the flavour. So the flavour is really just the smell and the taste together when you experience both of them in the mouth. And that really is the characteristic, those two senses together, as well as the texture, of course, those things together are what you appreciate when you do appreciate foods.
This was underlined for me, John, and I can't remember who told me the story that they had gone, they were in an Asian country, and they were told afterwards that they'd eaten dog. And then they were walking down the street the next day and they saw someone walking their poodles and they said their salivary gland reacted.
Well, that is unfortunate, isn't it? To develop a preference for dog after one for poodle in particular.
It just shows you everything at work, at play there.
I would have thought that after learning something was dog, you couldn't look at a dog in the same way again.
Just the next day they had to kind of overcorrect themselves to say, no, I can't develop this taste anymore.
Sausage dog.
Yes. But it's interesting, John, how do we actually train ourselves with something like durian where the smell is so overwhelming to then actually to consume that food? Is that just learnt?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people say, I've never been game to try it myself. Not that I'm particularly neophobic, but it is a particularly vile smell.
Yeah.
But people say once it's in the mouth that somehow the sweetness of the fruit and the rather odd aroma do seem to combine very well together and you develop a preference for it. And it's not very difficult in a way. Unless something is particularly revolting or, say, particularly bitter, we can normally develop a liking for it over a small number of exposures, 4, 5, 6, and so on, exposures will be enough to get us to start appreciating the flavour.
And does having a sweet background taste help with foods that may have a smell that might be overwhelming?
Absolutely. I mean, sweetness is one of the key attributes that of the foods that we tend to like. We're all born liking sweetness, and that doesn't vary in different cultures. It's part of our genetic inheritance that we are born liking sweetness. And that's a good thing because biologically sweetness tends to signal the presence of calories or energy. And so we need to take that in to survive. And so it's very, very adaptive that we like sweetness without any further encouragement. And so when you start pairing a flavour with a sweet taste, that liking that we have for sweetness gets transferred to the odor and the overall flavor of the food and ends up with inducing a preference for that food.
So just having a look at your book, John, and I love this line you say, so not only are our diets increasingly unrelated to survival, but they have also been hijacked by the desire for food as sensory pleasure. And so we've got this decoupling with survival and then pleasure and the reasons we're eating.
Yeah, hijacked probably too strong a word, really. I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with eating food for sensory pleasure, and in fact, very, very many of us do it all the time. But there is this issue, isn't there, that if we ate only for sensory pleasure, then our diets would be a little unbalanced. Carolyn, I think you'd probably agree with that what we tend to like without too much training is just foods that are high in sugar and high in fat and so on. And for the same reason that we are born liking sweet things, we're born liking anything that really provides us with energy, and fat is one of those things as well. And so the purely eating for pleasure provides us with a very real risk that we could end up with an unbalanced diet.
But do we take enough time, as a culture, to actually taste and have that sensory pleasure from food rather than just looking for volume and the fat content and that texture to actually tell us when we've actually consumed enough food?
Yeah, I think probably not. And the key, I think, to a healthy diet, and I make this point in the book, is that we're exposed to plenty of variety in foods from a very, very early age, and that we are allowed to develop likes for foods which perhaps don't seem that appealing initially. So, you know, there's no reason why we shouldn't find Brussels sprouts and cabbage and spinach and so on absolutely delicious. And, of course, many people do. But the key to that is having been exposed to these things. And I think one of the problems nowadays is that many people don't get exposed to a wide variety of vegetables, so that the preferences aren't allowed to develop.
And that natural neophobia that children have, and in some of my patients, one of my patients recently, we described her, you know, quite in a joking way, but as a sniffer dog. She could actually smell, she tells me, her mother could report of a 7-year-old, when water had been sitting and the chlorine had actually evaporated off versus when it hadn't. She was highly and it was principally smell. I said, well, how about we get you to actually be brave and hold your nose and actually taste foods? And obviously it was a completely different experience. So there is that genetic predisposition, isn't there, in some people to be highly sensory aware.
Yeah, you do see that with people's sense of smell. Some people are very, very sensitive to all sorts of things, and there's an equivalent sensitivity in taste, particularly for bitterness. And that's one of the things that you see. Some people are extremely bitter. And in your introduction, you were talking about somebody who didn't like marmalade and somebody didn't like the fruits in fruitcake, and both of those things can be quite bitter. So, in fact, that's probably what people were picking up on. And so some people are very, very sensitive to bitter things. You can overcome that in exactly the same way I talked about earlier. And that's probably important to overcome the bitterness that's in a lot of leafy green vegetables, for example. And again, that can be done by repeated exposure.
And then you start to crave it a bit.
Yeah, and of course the body, when it gets nutrients that it needs, it associates the getting of those nutrients, whether it's from carbohydrates or fats or other nutrients, it associates that with the flavour of the food and sets up a link automatically between something which is good for the body and a particular flavour.
But have we lost those signals because we're in that... that lovely term, the obesogenic environment, have we lost the ability to get the signals properly from our body about what we should be eating?
Well, I guess it comes down to what I was saying earlier, that is, it's about variety. I don't think we've lost that ability, but if all you're ever exposed to are foods which are high in sugars and high in fats and don't have other nutrients in them, then your diet becomes unbalanced. And you tend to always be finding those foods which are initially very, very appealing, but in the long run, as we know, aren't particularly good if our whole diet is composed of that. I personally don't believe there are such things as bad foods. I think there are bad diets. Not that I'm a dietitian, and my book wasn't really aimed at giving people advice on how to eat, although towards the end I really did feel the need to talk about that. I mean, I'm a great believer that one should never deny oneself pleasure from food, but at the same time you have to, you know, get your food pleasures from a wide variety of different foods.
Because you also speak about sensory specific satiety, where you actually can get, you know, bored or tired with that one flavour, let's say, even if it's a food that you enjoy initially, such as, you know, chocolate or fruit, that you actually do get a bit over it after a while, and we do naturally look for variety in flavours.
Absolutely. There's a drive for variety. I think that's a general drive that we as humans all have, that we have a drive for variety in all sorts of sensory stimulation, and food is one of those. It's a slight paradox, though. Of course, if you eat more variety, then you eat more food. But what I would argue is that's less of a problem. You know, eating more food isn't the issue, it seems to me. Eating one type of food is, you know, more damaging, as it were.
And what about the innate texture sensitivity that some of my patients will have for mushy food, or particularly with men who won't chew tomatoes, like cherry tomatoes, because they don't like that external kind of shell with the internal squish. And they can describe it beautifully. They go, and you can really see them backing away from the idea of actually eating a food that's got a mix of textures.
Mm.
You know, they're just not explorers with food. They don't like putting things in their mouth that are a bit challenging.
Yeah.
You know?
Again, coming back to the exposure to variety, from a very early age, if you are actually exposed a lot to variety, you get a greater liking for variety. And if you don't get that exposure, you very often, I think, get trapped in that early stage of neophobia that 2 to 4 or 2 to 5 year olds almost always have, that they won't try anything new. And so you do see adults who are absolutely terrified of some food. So you can, you know, mention things like, would you like a little bit of octopus? And that, you know, they recoil in horror at the thought of it. And very, very often, it's about the texture. If you ask people who don't eat oysters, for example, or sashimi or sushi, really one of the things that they people complain about, the main thing is, in fact, the texture. Nobody ever says that sashimi has a horrible flavour, because, of course, it's a very light flavour, but it's the thought that something slippery or slimy can be in the mouth, that perhaps they don't know how to manipulate it with the teeth and the tongue and so on, that in particular puts people off. So there's a special horror that people reserve for textures if they haven't experienced it.
And a lot of that comes when we're introducing solids too, of actually challenging babies to actually, you know, try different foods and explore and actually develop the skills around, because, you know, eating different textures is in itself a skill.
Mm.
But from a psychological point of view, how do you actually help patients who actually, you know, some patients who will only eat, you know, 4 foods, they will only eat toast with Vegemite or potato and steak and that's it. Now, taking your girlfriend out to an Asian restaurant when you're a young student is a bit challenging. It can be really fearful for these people.
Yeah, I think that's true. What we do naturally, of course, is whenever we're trying something new, we try and make it palatable. And this applies to children as well as adults. We try and make it palatable by putting it with something that we already like. And that could be as simple as making something very sweet. So, for example, most coffee drinkers start off drinking coffee, which is naturally bitter, by putting some sugar and some milk in it, and it gives it a much milder flavour. And so some people start off drinking beer by adding a bit of lemonade to it, and that's the same purpose. Or spirits with mixers and so on. So you make it palatable. With children, of course, one of the things that parents often do to encourage them to eat vegetables, some broccoli, for example, is to put a bit of tomato sauce on it.
And tomato sauce is, too.
Or applesauce, exactly. Mm. So those things are not only highly familiar, which is important, and that gets over the neophobia, the fear of eating something that's unknown, but it also is very sweet. And so I imagine that I could probably think back to my own past, but I can't quite recall the details. I imagine that when I first started eating Chinese food or anything Asian, I went for maybe honey prawns to start out with.
Sweet and sour.
Yeah, sweet and sour, exactly right. So which is more sweet than sour.
A lot of pineapple chunks. Yeah.
Exactly. So some familiar items that are very sweet, and that gets you into it. I have an interest in wine, and of course, if we all think back to when we started to drink wine, that the sort of wines we drank were, I can remember drinking Benny in Moselle. Oops, sorry, brand name. Moselle.
How fabulous to hear. Remember, there was whole comedy skits around that brand name. But
well,
anyway.
Exactly. And Matisse Rosé, which was quite sweet. Or at least pink.
And do you think you've just become a bit more of a wine snob, or do you think you've actually become braver, John? What has happened?
No, I don't think it's a matter of bravery. I think what happens is you start to, if you explore new wines, and, you know, once you can't keep drinking that no-name brand Moselle for the rest of your life, people will look at you strangely if you do. And so the if you start to explore new wines, you naturally develop a taste for drier and drier wines and start to appreciate the astringency of wine, or perhaps a little bit of bitterness or bite and so on. And you can get to like that. And there's no going back. That's, of course, a problem for one's wallet, but, you know.
And you knew this question was going to come up. A caller wants to know if you have any explanation for why Australians like Vegemite.
No, that's university tests have shown that's completely inexplicable. And And,
but John, talk to us about the rotten fish, the buried fish.
Oh yes, I love that. I read that.
Now that's got to be an equivalent, a northern hemisphere equivalent of Vegemite, surely.
Well, that's the Iceland one.
Yes,
I might tackle the Vegemite one first.
Properly.
Despite the university test. That's right. And it's an example of something which is, I think, naturally not that aversive in the sense that it's quite salty. It has that sort of bovrily, marmite-y sort of, I guess, what now we call umami taste, a very rich umami. Glutamate is very high in marmite and Vegemite and so on. And actually, you can show that the body values glutamate very highly. And of course, we have a natural affinity towards saltiness, too much so, but nevertheless. And so the body gets the vitamin B, the glutamate that it wants, as well as the salty hit. So it doesn't surprise me that in a culture where, you know, lots and lots of kids eat Vegemite, that lots and lots of kids end up liking it very much.
Sorry, John, you continue.
Well, I was just going to segue then into rotten shark. But I kicked the book off with that because for my palate, that's about the worst thing I could possibly imagine. That in Iceland and I think in some other Nordic countries, they take a particular type of shark, it's Greenland shark, and its body is rich in uric acid. And so they pop it in under the ground in gravel for months at a time, and what ends up happening, is, unsurprisingly, is it rots. And the local people find this a great delicacy to eat, these lumps of rotten shark meat, which is tastes very much like ammonia, I imagine, and they drink it with a sort of a vodka.
Yes, I think there has to be alcohol. Probably.
Yes, exactly. Perhaps a few shots first before they take a bite.
Quite a lot of alcohol.
And so that seemed to me about the most awful thing I could imagine, rotten fish. But nevertheless, it's a great example of the extremes that, so-called extremes, that people will go to create their own delicacies within a culture.
There's such a ritual around that one, though, isn't there? That would seem important to it.
I imagine there's a good deal of sort of pride of the locals in, yes, I can eat this despite the fact that it really is absolutely disgusting.
Mm. And, John, because, expectation and ritual are important, but, like, the pleasure that you can get from the expectation of food, someone said food always tastes better when it's cooked by someone else. Do you think we taste things differently when we haven't been tasting it or smelling it throughout the preparation stage, but when we come into a room and there's a roast cooking or, you know, that we just get an increased sense of hedonism about the pleasure, with the pleasure of the food?
I think that's true. And I think there are probably good physiological reasons for that. You mentioned earlier sensory-specific satiety, and that is that process whereby once we start to experience a sensory property, and that can be the sight of the food, the texture, it can be the colour of the food, it can be anything, the smell, obviously. Actually, the pleasure that it gives us actually starts to fall away. So by the time we as chefs come to eat it, it doesn't have that same innate pleasure that we have if it's just served up in front of us and we're getting that odour and the flavours for the very first time. So that I think is a good reason for why that process happens. And of course, you know, if you've ever cooked for a few hours, it's a tiring business, and there's a lot of effort expended in doing that. So maybe being in a more relaxed state also helps your appreciation of the food, and perhaps there's a surprise value as well, which is always pleasing.
And John, do you think we learn enough about, I mean, we do those simple tests when we're school children about, you know, bitter and sweet and putting different flavours on different parts of your tongue. But do you think we learn enough as children about the pleasures of enjoying food and taste?
No, I think we don't. And I think that's, it's cross-culturally, I think that's true. There's been some interesting studies, I think, in Finland where they, within schools, had children learning about foods, not just how to cook, not like a home economics class, but going to restaurants and sampling different sorts of food and encouraging them to eat a variety of foods. And those programs have been very successful. But I think there's a general view about foods that, and I think this is changing, but there has been a general view that foods, one really ought not to concentrate too much on the whole pleasure aspect. And this is a sort of duality of our approach to foods. On the one hand, you know, we recognise that it's fuel and there's such a thing as eating properly, and that one should only eat certain things frequently, you know, one's meat and one's potatoes, for example, and other foods should be reserved for treats. Now, of course, as you get more affluent, the economic reasons for doing that drop away, and there are fewer barriers to simply starting to enjoy food for pleasure. And our sort of Anglo-Saxon Protestant backgrounds are often at odds with that. You know, we have this feeling, well, should we really be enjoying food so much? Is it really, you know, something we ought to be spending so much time on? Mm. And as I say, I think this view is changing. I think that foods now is looking at foods and concerning oneself with foods is a major recreational activity in affluent countries these days.
Yes, I was told I had rocks in my head one day over the fruit thing when I was getting a whole lot of apricots, because I love them when they're in season. I love to stew them. And the person just went, "You've got rocks in your head, paying that price."
Yes.
But I went, "I love them."
Yes. And George Blair West, the psychiatrist who does a lot of obesity work, says we eat more because we taste less. And I think, okay, as you say, John, if it's a pleasurable food, then hopefully we'll enjoy it and eat a bit less if it's more energy dense or richer.
Mm. What's for lunch, John?
Look, I should have prepared something. I probably pheasant again.
Which you'll pick up with one hand.
Mm, yes.
Henry VIII style.
Blood dribbling down my tie.
Good on you, John. Lovely to have you show. Congratulations on the book, too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
It is great. It's fantastic. John Prescott, and his book is called Taste Matters, Why We Like the Foods We Do.
It's wonderful. It is a fantastic book. It really gets you thinking about...
It does.
Do I actually taste that? What is that about that I like or don't like?
And Vegemite is discussed.
Yes. I don't think it's quite in the same vein as the shark.
Yeah. But look, Caroline, thank you. You bring us sort of great subject matter.
It's a wonderful next time. We're going from one extreme to the other.
Tell me you're going to crunch on something other than a biscuit with snap at lunchtime.
No, we're doing eosinophilic esophagitis in 2 weeks.
Oh.
Yes, children who actually can't eat.
Oh.
So extreme allergies. So it will be very interesting.
Goodbye, Fit Dietitian, as she heads off up another hill. You're on 28 to 11. And we will be talking sport with Rory very soon. But news headlines time and a very good morning to Mark Dawson.